John, be a responsible pet owner. The first of the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opal Song. Author's notes. For Anon at Bucket List. Q. Most important thing you own? John. My troll, but I don't like to say I own him. We're just kind of buddies. When you get home, Equius is waiting for you by the door, which he hasn't really done since the first week after you brought him home. Gosh, that week was nerve-wracking. You spent so much time pestering Dave and Rose with questions, since they'd already had trolls for ages, and you were so sure you would mess up with yours. He's kneeling, back ramrod straight, hands on his thighs, his blue and yellow eyes wide. He really looks like he needs a hug. Hey, buddy, you say as you drop your keys on the table and kick your shoes off. What's wrong? Equius chews on his lip like he's nervous about answering you, which is weird. He's really good about being obedient. It was one of the reasons you got him as your first pet. Dave's bro was the one who found him and suggested him for you. Equius came from a really good bloodline and had been trained well, but his broken horn wasn't growing back, so he had to be sold at a discount. You have a scratch and dent troll. It's kind of adorable. You touch his mouth with one fingertip to remind him to stop chewing. Don't hurt yourself, you say. Come on, let's go sit on the couch and relax, and you can tell me what the problem is. He gets up and follows you into the living room, and you pat the couch next to you when you sit down. He still needs to be encouraged to actually use the furniture. When you leave him to his own devices, he's spooked all the time, like he thinks he'll break things by touching them. He sits, carefully, and you pull him down so you can pet his hair. So, you say, what were you up to while I was gone?
I watched your program, he says.
You laugh awkwardly. Not the best interview I've ever given, you say. You're still not used to being even a little bit famous. Equius clings to your pant leg a little, his shoulders hunching.
You said you don't like owning me, he says really quietly.
What? You say, flummoxed for a minute. You're pretty sure you said no such thing. Then you remember that one weird question. No, buddy, that's not what I meant. I like having you here. I like you a lot. You huff out air in a rush, trying to explain yourself. It's just, saying I own you sounds creepy. I own my car. I own my furniture. It's just stuff. You're not just stuff.
You're not going to get rid of me? Equius asks.
No, you say firmly. Definitely not. No getting rid of. Dave and Rose were both really clear about that, in their own special ways, heh, when you started talking about getting a troll of your own. They both had rescue trolls whose first owners didn't care, and the abandonment issues are, in Dave's words, a catastrophe of massive tear-jerking proportions, Egbert, so think carefully about whether you want to take this dive. You slide your fingers up through Equius's hair until you can massage the base of his broken horn, which is pretty much always a good scritching spot. He starts to relax, and you watch the tension ease out of his shoulders. He starts making that low, thrumming sound in his chest that Rose insists isn't a purr on a technicality. But it sounds pretty purr-like to you, and it means the same thing. All the manuals say so. It's an instinctive noise produced when a troll feels safe and receptive to touch. Wild trolls are apparently really violent, so they need to have signals about when it's okay to get within arm's reach, just so they don't attack each other all the time.
I'm glad you want to keep me, he says. His voice goes rumbly in a really neat way when he's purring. I like being yours. Well, that sure makes you feel warm and smooshy inside. Good, you say. I want you to be happy here. You keep scritching, watching him calm down and stop being so nervous. Watching the way he sort of squirms around when he starts really getting into being touched. He's big for a troll, almost human-sized, and blues tend to be really muscular. And between those two things, he's... Well, sometimes watching him move makes you feel pretty funny in your pants. Which you have tried to be tactful about. You know some people do that with their trolls, and you're not judging. It's just that Equius is so well-trained and so eager to please, you'd worry about him going along with stuff he didn't like, and then you'd feel like such a jerk. The way he's moving now, though, man, you can watch the slide of all those muscle groups in his back that you don't know the names for, and when his hips roll, your mouth goes sort of dry. You shift your weight a little, and let your right hand take over horn-scritching duty, so you can reach down with your left and scratch your nails, bitten short and blunt as they are, down his back. Equius moans. There goes your ability to ignore what's going on in your pants. Wow, you say all softly. You feel good, huh? That's nice. Mmm, he says. Yes, it feels... And he just breaks off right there, rocking his hips, shivering. You feel sort of shivery yourself watching him move. There was actually a part of you that just figured he didn't feel this kind of stuff. Like, the breeder had him fixed before selling him to you. But it sort of looks like that just means he can't make more trolls. Not that he can't, feel exciting things. You lick your lips. You can take your shorts off, if that would feel good, you say, and your voice comes out a little funny. Equius nods, almost poking you in the leg with his good horn, and reaches for the buttons of his shorts right away. Some people also don't keep their trolls dressed at home. Rose has sent you some really elegant photos of Kanaya lounging naked on fancy couches in her house. But you have always been not so sure about that. It occurs to you now that maybe he would rather not be wearing clothes. And you've just assumed without ever asking. Being a responsible pet owner is hard. He squirms out of his shorts, and you can see a blue flush around the sheath of his bulge. It's starting to swell and open up already. Just from a little scratching, huh? You ask. Equius hunches in on himself. I apologize for my poor self-control, he says. You laugh. Don't apologize, you say. It's fine. I'm glad you're enjoying it. You drag your nails down his chest, and his purr gets louder. His hips arch a little, and the tip of his bulge slips free of the sheath. Dark blue and shiny wet. You've heard they're prehensile. You lick your lips again. You almost say, should I keep doing this? Except that you've noticed it makes Equius sort of nervous and confused when you ask him what you should do. Instead, you say, tell me if anything I do feels bad, because I want you to have a good time. You keep rubbing behind one horn and scratch his chest and belly some more. You're sort of proud of your dexterity right now, actually. Equius purrs and digs his shoulder blades into the couch under him. He's wiggling. Gosh, that's cute. And it makes you feel so good to see that under all the serious business training, he can still remember how to just be happy sometimes. There you go, buddy, you encourage him. That's nice, huh?
Yes, he says. Yes. The words barely rising out of the purr.
He rocks his hips up again when your hand strays low across his belly, and you think maybe this really is okay after all. You let your fingertips drift lower, trace the opening of his bulge sheath, and his bulge slides out to twine around your fingers. That is the cutest thing. You might say, aww, a little. You curl your fingers, stroking it, letting it twine between them. It slides further out to get a better grip on you. And mostly, you're just fascinated until Equius moans again. And that reminds you that you're playing with his junk. And that your own feels kind of neglected. Okay, hang on a second, you say, and scoot out from under him so you can get up. He watches you like he's not sure what's going on, but he trusts you, whatever you have in mind. It makes your heart feel a little funny. You unzip your jeans and then figure you might as well go all the way with this and pull your shirt off over your head before shoving your jeans and your boxers down. Equius is watching you sort of curiously, and you definitely catch the moment when he looks down at your dick and then looks away really fast. His bulge squirms against his belly, leaving little blue trails across his skin. Here we go, you say, climbing back onto the couch with him. You coax him to stretch out and lower yourself down on top of him, bracing your weight carefully. When your dick rubs up against his bulge, it curls right around you. Oh, you say, wow, yeah. Equius nods frantically, his bulge twisting and squeezing rhythmically. Is this, may I, he says, his hands sliding tentatively up your sides. Yeah, you say, go ahead and touch. It feels good. You thrust into the grip of his bulge, and that's awesome. Slick and gripping you just right. You let your head fall forward, forehead against his shoulder, and hum a low moan of your own as his bulge slides across the really sensitive spot just behind the head of your dick. You kiss him along the alien curve of his collarbone, and he clings to you, his hands on your back and his bulge on your dick. And you're pretty much just letting your hips do what comes naturally at this point. The noises Equius makes are kind of amazing. The purrs in high gear, and it makes all of his moans have a rumbly undertone to them. And his breath comes in harsh, warm puffs past your ear. When you let your teeth scrape his skin a bit, experimentally, he croons wordlessly and shudders all over. You bite him a little harder. Trolls are pretty rough with each other, right? And he bucks hard enough that he almost throws you. Please, please, yes, he says. And hearing actual need in his voice pretty much wrecks you. Yeah, I got you, you tell him. I got you. It's good. You're doing really good. Ah! And you give up trying to talk about then, because wow, and also, oh my god, the things he's doing to you, slick and squirming and pulsing. You bite again, right at the base of his throat, and this time you're ready for it, when that makes him start to thrash. You hold on tight and let his needy sounds wash over you and feel the way he's squeezing you tight. Oh, God, milking your dick, and your desperate losing it sound is muffled by his skin as you blast right past the point of no return and come all over him, a big, shuddering mess. His bulge is still coiled around you, squirming a little when you finish. and you try to just stick that out, but you're pretty sensitive, and it's a little uncomfortable. When you try to pull back, slowly, because yanking when you're tangled up like this seems likely to be uncomfortable for both of you, he whimpers a little, but he lets you go. You wedge yourself into the tiny space between the back of the couch and Equius, still pressed against his side. There are a few strands of hair stuck to his forehead, damp with sweat. You reach up and smooth them back off his face, and he smiles at you.
"You are satisfied?"
he asks.
"Oh man, yeah," you say, grinning at him.
"You bet I am. How about you? Did you, There's no great way to ask this, and you feel sort of weird about it, because you've heard they make, like, bucket loads of mess, and you don't see any evidence of that. "Did you get off?" Equius blushes deep blue across his cheekbones, and that's kind of stupid adorable.
Yes, he says. Three times.
"Haha, wow, really?" you say. You definitely need to learn more about how trolls work. "Awesome!" He looks sort of shy about that, but he leans into you, and that's adorable.
I'm glad it pleases you, he says.
"Of course it does, silly," you tell him. You realize he always seems a little surprised, a little confused, when you make a point to care of him, or worry about making him happy. You know you missed something, being so hung up on me not liking the word own, you point out. You kiss his forehead. "The question was about what's most important to me, and I picked you." Equius looks up at you with such adorable puppy eyes, you think you might just melt right there.
"I'm very glad," he says. "I am happy to be yours."
"That's really sweet," you tell him. "I promise, I'm going to do my best to take good care of you." You look down at the sticky mess drying on his stomach. His fluids, and yours. Starting with getting you washed up, I think, and then we'll see about making dinner. How's that sound? Equius smiles at you, and yeah, melting time. "Excellent," he says. The end. Bro, consider something more permanent. The second in the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opal Song. Author's notes. Years in the past, but not many. The newest member of your household is under your bed when you get home, and your little bro has fresh band-aids on his face. The flat stare he gives you tells you he is holding you personally responsible.
"He's still not settling in so good, huh?"
you say, as you hand off one of your Mickey D's bags. Dave pops a handful of French fries in his mouth.
"No, he's doing great," he says, with his mouth full. "The perfect family pet."
You nod. "Knew I could count on you," you say, and take the rest of the food to your room. You drop the bag on the table, where a couple of smuppets can keep it warm. You get down on the floor to look under the bed. Two bright, alien eyes, one blue and one red, gleam at you from the darkness.
"Come on out of there," you tell your new troll.
Solix takes a swipe at your face, but you were expecting that, and you dodge. You're actually kind of used to this by now. Pretty much all the trolls that wind up at your place are damage cases. It's like any exotic pet craze, right? You get a few people who really know what they're getting into, and then a bunch of others who get bored or don't have the time or can't cope with their needs or whatever. And then guys like you wind up trying to look after little broken aliens that somebody else couldn't take good care of. I got some food for you, but you can't have it under there, you say. It's important to be clear about this stuff, especially with the new ones. You stay calm with them, but you let them know where the limits are. Your house looks like a big, chaotic mess to human visitors, but it's got rules, and trolls tend to get that pretty quick. Not hungry, Solix tells you. He's most definitely lying. The poor thing's a sack of bones, but you don't call him on it. Okay, well, I'm just going to eat my dinner, you say. When you do get hungry, come on out and we can share. Maybe you ought to be trying to get him to eat healthy, but quarter-pound fillet of questionable meat product is already more like food than that shitty dry troll chow that unscrupulous pet stores claim is adequate. And maybe getting a few extra calories into him will be a good start. You sit down at your computer, back turned to the bed on purpose. You've got revenue streams to check up on, and new content to upload. Niche porn sites don't run themselves. You leave an anonymous flame on Dave's latest comic. When he can guess which of the week's comments is you, you owe him a pizza. He's getting better at it. While you catch up on work, you munch your way through most of the shitty sandwiches and unnervingly addicting fries in your bag. Solix has got to be able to smell that. You go slow, giving him time to think about it. When you see a little yellowish-gray hand reaching for the last wrapped sandwich, you don't move. You let him take it, slow and careful, like he's worried about getting caught. He's got a lot to learn about being sneaky enough for Casa Strider. Remember, no food under the bed, you say conversationally as his hand leaves your field of vision. He hisses like you've startled him. But when you turn around a few seconds later, he's crouched beside the bed, not stuffing himself back under it, with about half the sandwich in his mouth already. He swallows a couple of times and then tells you, "That's a stupid rule. It makes sense to eat somewhere safe." "Dude, you are somewhere safe," you say. He probably won't believe you this time, but it won't hurt to start saying it. "This whole apartment is your safe place, okay? Me and Dave, we're here to be your packmates now. Cohorts," Solix corrects you, and then cringes like he expects to be in trouble. "Right, cohorts," you say, retrieving stray French fries from the bottom of the bag. "We strife each other. Sometimes, yeah, but we're on the same side. And you're on our side, too." Solix finishes inhaling the sandwich. "Only until you can find a way to get rid of me," he says. "I'm not stupid. I know what fostering is." He cranes his head to look around you at the bag. You take the cue, reaching in there to pull out an apple pie, still sort of warm and everything. You hand it to him, and he takes it, careful not to let your fingers touch. "Not being stupid was part of the problem at your old place, huh?" you ask. "I got bored," Solix says, hunching his shoulders defensively. He sniffs at the pie box once, then tears it open with shaking fingers to bite into it. You make a mental note to hit an actual grocery store sometime this week and buy one of those frozen ones you stick in the oven. A whole entire pie would probably double his lifetime supply of kind gestures. "Idiots just left you home all day with nothing to do, didn't they?" You know the type. They pick up a troll for some dumb, shallow reason, and they don't want to invest a lot of attention, which is always a bad plan. But an extra bad plan with a high-strung bloodline like Yellow's tend to be. Solix nods. He's already licking the last of the pie goo off his fingers.
It fucked, he says. You nod. I'd believe it, you say.
Inspiration strikes.
Hey, you ever get to play video games?
Solix gives you a really suspicious stare.
Are you trying to coax me out into the other room now?
No, dude, too much, too fast, you say.
But I've got a PSP around here somewhere. Hang on.
The chaos of your room is a clever trap for unwary little brothers who try to go through your stuff. You know where everything is. It's a matter of seconds to dig out your PSP, which might even still have some battery life left, and a couple of game options. You sit on the edge of the bed, close enough to be easy to reach, far enough that you don't give Solix a good reason to bolt.
Here, check these out, you say.
The system looks pretty big in his hands, but he's got long fingers. He'll probably manage.
I could take this back under the bed, he points out to you slyly.
Come up here and give it a try with me first, you ask.
Just for a minute, Solix says. I can see what you're doing here.
He's such a skittish little thing.
All right, just for a bit, you say.
Eventually, he'll realize that you're not being nice as a front or anything. But it'll take time. You settle in on your bed, and Solix crawls up next to you, a bundle of mismatched eyes and skinny limbs and stubby, doubled horns. You get a racing game fired up for him, and he hunches in over it in concentration, lisping little curses as he gets the hang of the controls. He doesn't even freak out when you move closer. A few minutes later, he lets you sit there, almost leaning against his side, and after a few minutes of that, he starts to relax into your warmth. After a few minutes of that, it starts to hit you. You actually really like this little guy.
Sure, yeah, in general, you like trolls. You think they're neat. You like being able to help them out.
But Solix in particular, smart and defensive and lispy, and sort of weirdly cute. Okay, you put the brakes on for now. If it's too soon for him to be comfortable chilling with you and Dave in the living room, then it is worlds too soon to talk about making this permanent. You can let the idea hang out in the back of your head, though, while the rest of you ponders whether you'd get bitten for trying to scritch Solix's horns. You're good at multitasking like that. You'll just start considering it now. And by the time he's ready to give it some thought, you'll be prepared. The end. Gamzee, Be the Considerate Idiot. Part 3 of the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opal Song. Notes. This one is later than part 2, but earlier than part 1. Chapter 1. You got a couple different kinds of hunting you do, keeping your tiny cohort in good shape. You try to switch up, not get in patterns, because a troll who ain't got no collar and tags is a troll who has to be motherfucking careful how he steps. And fuck if your traitorous paws ain't got their own ideas. You're up and halfway across town to that lady with the nip toys before you motherfucking catch yourself and turn around. You got enough of that stuff to be getting on, and you know if you come around too often, she'll be all up and happy to call somebody to pick you up for your own motherfucking good. Can't let her think you're too desperate. Dumpsters get a pretty good haul out behind some of the restaurants downtown. The ones where they really only got a thin wire holding the flap shut. Maybe don't feel so good tearing those motherfuckers loose, but you can do it. And they're all up and full of delicious surprises. You gotta go pretty late at night for that, though, if you don't want to run into some law-abiding citizen telling you to cut it the fuck out, or some pack of drunk male humans looking to show off for each other by fighting something. That only happened once. You still avoid the fuck out of that part of town. While your head's all pondering how good an idea those dumpsters are, your feet have gone and voted for another option altogether. You're headed on over to see these guys you know, up in one of them big beehive-looking apartment things. A big troll who's good at climbing, like you, can get up on the creaky fire ladder up at the back of the building, and if you rap-pap-pap on the window, those brothers will open up and let you in. Let you back out again. Two. That's the real miracle. You haul your bad self up on there, and peer on in through the window to see what they got going on. It is a right motherfucking circus in the Strider Brothers' kitchen tonight. Looks like they got a new troll visitor, all crouched up tiny under the kitchen table, bundled up tight, with just the sharp end of a little pig sticker pointing out from his blanket. You don't see Soulbro nowhere, but both Striders are all up in there. Little one keeping Rezzy from going after the new kid. Big one trying to be non-threatening and all motherfucking reasonable down on the floor. Maybe this ain't the best time to be imposing on a brother's charity, you figure. They got some motherfucking juggling to do without you even saying a first word. Little one sees you watching, though. Says something about it that you can't hear through the glass. His bro gets up and comes to slide the window up. "Hey, Gamzee," motherfucker says, and you share a fist bump with him to say hi. "We got a no sudden moves and no loud noises rule going on tonight. You chill?" "I am the chilliest of chill motherfuckers," you promise, and he steps back to let you inside. You plunk down on the cracked plasticky floor and shrug your backpack off. And then you sink into a crouch so you can get a look at the new guy. Little motherfucker hisses at you when you look at him. And he's got the brightest red eyes you ever saw. Something in your blood pusher up and rolls right the fuck over. Not quite like how it went when you saw Tavbro for the first time, but just as hard. "No fights in the house, remember?" Strider says. "From some place way up there." You wave the words off, like you could all be fighting with anyone that made you feel like this. "We're cool, brother," you promise. You get right down on the floor, on your back, looking up at the kid as best you can. You splay your hands out so he can see they're empty, and then you fire up your rattlebox so he can hear you hum. It's a little weird doing that in front of the humans, but by now you don't think they're dumb enough to come rub your belly their own selves. Your sad little miracle stares at you from under the table for a minute, like he don't know what all to do with you. And then that poor little motherfucker starts to cry. Your blood pusher ties itself in knots. The top note in your hum pushes to the front of the sound, a little croon of, "Let me look after you." "I can't remember how to do that," he tells you, his voice all creaky and scratchy, like he motherfucking screamed himself right out. "Ain't no hurry," you tell him. Your hum gets all up into your voice, gives it a case of the wobbles. You feel it when you feel it, and that kind of righteous noise will up and make itself when it's time. Sad little brother sniffles and tries to glare at you. "You're an idiot," he says. You bust out laughing, but you try to keep it quiet on account of he's still holding that little knife he probably got out of a kitchen drawer, and you don't want him to go all panicky with it. "I guess maybe I've been told that a time or two." He sniffs again, and maybe looks just a little bit like he'd smile if he weren't holding on to his guard like that. "Well, whoever told you that was right?" "I'm Gamzee," you tell him. "You got a lot of idiot motherfuckers to keep straight, yeah? so I better be up and having a label of my own.
At least you're considerate, idiot, I guess, he says. Carcat.
Then he reaches out and puts one hot little paw on yours, and just lets it stay there, even when your thumb gets to wandering over his knuckles. The two of you sit there for a while like that, and you keep up your hum, while the Striders fuck around in the kitchen and step over you on their way to doing whatever. Place gets to smelling pretty fine after a bit. Strider crouches down and peeks under the table at the pair of you, cocked head and pointy shades.
We're about to have dinner, FYI, he says. If you guys want to come out of there, you can help yourselves.
You squeeze Karkat's hand a little.
What do you think, brother? I could be all murdering for whatever that is smelling so good.
I don't believe you could murder a rabbit, Karkat says, but he starts to wiggle on out of there.
Shit no, you agree. Cute little things ain't done nothing to me, and they're too bitty to even make a good meal.
Idiot, Karkat says. He don't sound all up and ready to start crying anymore.
And that does you good right down to your bones.
He leaves the knife and the blanket behind, and that does you even better. When the both of you get standing up, he comes up a little short of your shoulders, and he maybe glares at you and puffs up a little like you done that on purpose. But you don't pay that no mind. There's plates on the counter, and one of them basket things full of pasta in the sink, and a pot of red sauce to go on it. And free, easy food is a miracle you don't ever want to turn down.
Seems like the whole motherfucking house agrees with you on that one. Even Solix shows up out of wherever he was hiding to sit next to Strider, all knees and elbows and delicate little munching fangs.
Terezi gets all up in Dave's business and eats about half her dinner off his fork, giggling about it every time he tries to tell her to get her own, and then turns out not to mean it.
Karkat makes sure to keep you between him and everyone else, but they act like they ain't even noticed his bad manners. Like this, you can kind of see how having a bigger cohort would be nice. A whole little crew of brothers and sisters to call your own. It'd be you and... You are one stupid, forgetful motherfucker. Shit, you guys. I hate to fucking eat and run, but I gotta get my sorry ass home, you say.
What?
Karkat says, grabbing your shirt.
Fuck you! No, you need to stay!
You're kind of a terrible motherfucker right now, and you know it. There's no way not to be.
Nah, bro. I got somebody waiting for me, you explain, putting your hand on his. Little dude ain't got nobody but me, and you got this whole motherfucking crew to watch your back.
Karkat shakes his head urgently.
Don't leave me with the humans,
he whispers, so quiet you can barely hear him.
You try to think fast, and this is the part where you're really glad you ain't had a whole bag of nip to keep you company tonight.
Little sister, think you could come and drop some wicked sage advice on me over here?
Terezi slides off Dave's lap and comes sauntering over, showing off all her shark teeth. You keep holding Karkat's hand, and he goes tense as she gets closer.
Wicked sage advice is our specialty, she says. How can we be of assistance this evening?
I got to be all heading back to take care of my little bro, you explain. But I ain't got any kind of good feelings about walking away from this brother right here. You got any good thoughts on how I could be sure he's going to stay all safe till I get back here?
Are you asking me if I'm taking my duties seriously as a leader of this cohort?
Terezi says to you, all sweet-like.
I'm offended that you would need to ask the question.
She tilts her head in Karkat's direction and lowers her voice.
I won't let anyone hurt you in my house, you know.
Karkat looks like it hurts him to hear it, the poor motherfucker.
It's the human's house, he rasps.
Terezi cackles. That's what they think.
She reaches out to him, like her blindness ain't even a thing. Cups his face in her hands, easy as breathing. His eyes go big and round, but he holds still. And she leans in real close.
I mean it, she tells him, soft and sweet as lovers. If anyone tries to hurt you, I will make them pay.
You can tell just looking. Ain't nobody ever said a thing like that to Carcat before. He opens his mouth and then doesn't say a motherfucking thing. Just shuts it again and blinks some more.
There, see? You smile at Carcat's confused, adorable face. And you'd lay a motherfucking hug on him if he'd let you. But it ain't time for that particular miracle just yet. This fine sister gonna take good care of you till I come back.
You're coming back? Carcat says, and the look on his face turns you right inside out.
You promise?
Hell yes, you tell him. Hell fucking yes. You smile. These motherfuckers can't get rid of me.
You're a one-troll cockroach infestation, Dave says, getting up from the couch himself, because he knows a motherfucking cue when he hears one.
Come on, Mr. Miracles, let's go pack a lunch for your imaginary girlfriend.
Chapter 2.
It's a whole little parade coming back to where you left your bag. Dave scoops that motherfucker off the floor and starts loading it up. All kinds of cans with them rings on the top so you can pop them open nice and easy. Couple of kinds of human food and a few cans of the mushed-up troll nutrition stuff that tastes boring as shit, but makes you feel a little better when you're all up and sickly.
You know, he says as he tucks in a little packet of them black licorice things you like.
Offer still open, if you want to bring him by sometime.
You stuff your hands in your pockets. It makes you feel kind of squirmy nervous to think about.
I might, one of these days, you say, because it's hard to give a flat no to a motherfucker what helps you out all the time. But the thing is, if shit went bad, you could break a motherfucking window, or a motherfucker's arm, on the way to get the hell out. Tavbro wouldn't have such an easy time of it.
No pressure, right? But the option's there.
He adds a couple of Tav's favorite peanut butter chocolate cup things.
You guys can park your bony asses in the living room and watch crappy movies together, and we'll order some pizzas.
With pepperoni and cherries, Terezi says from behind you.
Dave makes a totally fuck-awful face.
Shit no, Rez. You can't put cherries on pizza.
That's like one of the Ten Commandments.
Lies, Terezi says happily. I have heard your Ten Commandments, and they have no pizza in them at all.
Yeah, these motherfuckers will do Carcat a world of miracles.
You shrug into your backpack and look over at him, and he's still just all watching you, quiet and intense, with his eyes so crazy bright like stoplights. For a second, you just want to tuck him under your arm and carry him off with you. But you ain't that big an idiot. You'd shoot this whole balancing act to hell in a second you went and did something like that. Instead, you just hold out your hand, and he takes it and squeezes tight.
Come back soon, he says.
You nod. Less than a week, you promise. Pretty sure you couldn't make yourself stay gone longer than that, the way he looks at you.
Okay,
he says, and lets you go. You get your night vision back pretty quick as you swing, tumble, pounce your way down to street level again, and that helps you stay the fuck out of trouble as you head home. You're all up in the habit of sticking to the dark when you go out wandering, because you know you've gotten big enough to make people nervous, and the last motherfucking thing you need is to get troll welfare called on you. Those motherfuckers would cull you sure for refusing to be somebody's pet. Even on your worst days, You don't want to up and leave Tavros alone like that. Shit, you want to get your sorry ass home in a hurry. Your head's turning into a spooky place to be. Home is this empty old shell of a house in a part of town most people plain forgot about, even though a few humans still try to live around here too. They don't even fucking look after each other. How could you trust them to look after you? You and Tav moved in here last winter, and mostly it's been pretty chill, after one or two scrapes where somebody else wanted to kick you out so they could have that roof for their own selves. One time, you came home to find Tav holding off three guys by his lonesome, snarling and tossing his wicked horns, and fuck if it weren't the scariest night of your life. Didn't stop shaking till long after you got the motherfucking blood off your claws. Tonight, there ain't no trouble when you get there. No wrong smells when you pry back the loose plywood over that one back window and crawl on in through there. Just you down there in the dark, and from upstairs, a set of slow, lopsided steps, you know, just as good as a motherfucking heartbeat. You take them creaky, awful stairs, three at a go, so you can get all up there to him faster. When you get up top, Tav's over at the far end of the room, right by where you keep your pile. Hand on the wall like he's all taking a breather from the hard motherfucking work of moving around. He looks up and sees you there, and his face just fucking lights up with that smile that tells you everything's gonna be okay. "Welcome home," he says. "Best place in the motherfucking world to be," you say. You take a step forward, and he shakes his head, just a little. So you pull up right there and just fucking wait while he lets go of the wall and pulls himself up straight and walks across the room to meet you. These shuffling little achy steps that break you right into little pieces inside. You can see it right in his face how hard he's working, and it's only his beautiful motherfucking pride that keeps you from going to snatch him up in a hug right there. You hold your motherfucking horses, though, and Tavbro makes it right on over to you on his own two feet. Then you catch him up in a badass motherfucking hug, because he is the most huggable badass you know.
"I'm glad you're back," he says, warm breath in your ear.
"I am righteous motherfucking glad to be here, bro," you say. Just breathing him in does you a fucking world of comfort. Makes you let go of a lot of that blood and culling stuff that fills up your head when you go outside. "Let's go get our cuddle on, babe, and let me share out this sack of miracles I got here."
"That sounds good to me,"
Tav says, and lets you keep an arm right around him as you head over to the pile. You think he might have been working his bad leg the whole time you were gone. And it hits you all over again, just how tough this sweet little motherfucker is. You make it over there and help him down easy, then shrug out of your bag and start hunting through the pile. Most of the shit you guys own is up in here someplace, where you can keep an eye on it, and that includes your stash. "Fuck yeah, here we go," you say when you find your nip bag. There's a little more in there than you thought you had. Tav's opening up your backpack to go through there while you measure out a pinch of nip in your hand. He finds the licorice and passes that to you, then pulls out the peanut butter cups and grins all doofy and adorable.
"Did you go see the Striders again?" he asks.
"Yeah, it was a right wicked party over there," you say. "They got a new guy, sweetest little scaredy kitten you ever saw." You watch Tav setting his candy aside all careful-like. You know he's going through it slow as he can. Maybe it's the nip all tingling under your tongue, but you add, "Motherfuckers still want to meet you." Like that's a thing that could up and happen.
"Hmm,"
Tav says, digging a spoon out of the pile and popping open one of the cans.
"Sometimes, I think, they might not be so bad."
He waves the spoon at his legs.
"I still get tired too easily,
So, maybe not yet.
Can't be too motherfucking careful, you agree. You sit there quiet for a minute, letting the nip round off your twitchy edges, and watching Tav put his fucking dinner away like a champ. You ain't said a word to those guys about Tav's legs. They ain't the kind of motherfuckers as would try to cull him and call it a fucking quality of life issue. But you're all sorts of worried they'd think they could take better care of him than you can. You ain't ever got to go see them, right? Tav nods, smiling at you like he can see right into your head and knows how much you're worrying, and he's grateful for it. I'm not in a hurry, anyway, he says. This is just fine, for now. He polishes off the last of his food and sets the can down, licking his chops all satisfied. You done good tonight. You're pretty motherfucking sure. You're really motherfucking sure when the next thing Tav does is roll over to drape an arm over you and pull you down into kissing range. Hell fucking yes. Getting your makeout on is about the best thing you could possibly be doing right now. All your ugly parts get to melting down as you tangle up in each other, arms and legs all wrapped up and his mouth moving slow against yours. Your hum kicks up and his does too, counterpoint to yours. Beautiful fucking music when you're both making that noise together. You ain't altogether sure who starts the next bit, whether he gets his hands up under your shirt first or you do his. Ain't no motherfucking race anyhow. The bit that fucking matters is claws on skin all gentle-like, and the warm, sweet feeling you get all running through your veins when Tav moves with you. Well, the way your bulge wakes up and gets to pulsing, that's pretty good, too. You skin one hand down, knuckles brushing the front of his jeans, and Tav's hum rolls into high gear. Yes, please, he says, soft, right up against your mouth. Anything you want, babe, you tell him, and you mean it all through. He smiles. But especially this thing that you also want, he says. Every bit of you sings with how right this is, and you're laughing as you nod. Can't fucking argue with that, you say. I told you lately that you're a clever little motherfucker. You could always, he pushes your shirt up, tell me again. You're tugging his to match. If you wanted. He's right. You totally fucking could. Bro, you're the moon and the stars, you tell him, as your hands get all to working on his buttonfly. You're my most favorite miracle of all. You know that? He kisses your jaw, bites just a little, humming right against your throat. Went and put the colors in the fucking rainbow. Ain't no motherfucker could tell me different. You slide your thumb over his sheath, and the tip of his bulge comes curling out to say hello. Oh, Tav says, pushing on into your hand, tugging to get your pants down so he can be all returning the motherfucking favor. Your bulge is plenty motherfucking happy to see him, that's for sure. Sliding right out to get friendly with his fingers. You are my favorite miracle, also, he tells you, all soft, barely enough voice to come out over the hum. Being with you is the best thing. Truth be told, ain't either of you got a whole lot of other nice things to compare, but that kind of ugly thinking don't belong up in this cuddle pile. So you shoo it right out the door again. Right now is for kissing Tav's sweet mouth and letting his music get all up in your heart. For wiggling closer until his bulge and yours can be tangle buddies, and that feels good enough to fill your head right up. Don't leave any room for troubles at all. You let your eyes fall shut and just love what you got right here, right now. Tav's arms warm around you, and Tav's bulge coiling all in ripples around yours, slick and strong, and the sweet colors blooming all across your shut-up eyelids. You got a croon you can't even help, and you feel like you could just drift away, not sure where your edges are all at. There's a knot of bright heat down at the base of your core, and the rest of you is a puddle spreading out from there. And then Tav's hand is down there again, and you realize he's easing the tip of your bulge away from his nook. "Sorry," he says, with that motherfucking adorable little smile. "Nah, ain't nothing for you to be all sorry about," you say, trying to pull together enough attention, "you can do this right. I'm the one who's up in spacing the fuck out and forgetting where I'm all going. Bodies, man. They know what the fuck they want to do, and sometimes, if one of you don't paint no attention, let's be straight, you know that it's you most times. Then a bulge might do a little wandering, looking for something to curl up inside. But that ain't a good risk for you to be taking, and what the hell would you do with grubs anyway? So you pull it together long enough to remember where you're up and pointing that thing. 'Cause it ain't like any kind of hardship to be all wrapped up in Tav's bulge and squeezing. Feels fucking beautiful just like that, drawing your nerves right in, winding you tight enough to feel like fuck. Feels fucking beautiful like that, drawing your nerves right in, winding you tight enough you feel like fuck. Bucket? Tav says, going breathless, and you nod. That was his idea. Up and keeps the both of you from spilling a colorful mess all over your own selves or your pile. All you gotta do is get your aim on, right there at the end, and you get your own personal peanut butter and jelly all nice and contained, somewhere where it won't do you no fucking hassle later on. And here you are fucking marveling at that miracle of cleverness right up until you get dragged back into the miracle of right this minute as Tav bucks and shivers and starts filling the pail, and you up and follow his example. God damn. He's even got it together enough to push the pail out of the way before you both up and collapse back into the pile, still kind of tangly and unwinding slow. You plant a kiss on his sweet motherfucking mouth, because there ain't no way you could help yourself. And the tone of his hum changes from hungry to just plain chill with the world, just like what your own rattlebox got going on. You do that for a little bit, letting your tongues tangle while your bulges figure out how to get unwound, and maybe your fingertips go walking to just trace out all the shapes of his face, 'cause you don't ever get tired of being amazed at him all over again. You take a little stock once all your parts done put themselves away, and yeah, all the noise in your head up and smoothed itself right out while you've been getting your cuddle on. Your skin sits all nice and easy on your bones, the miracle of being okay for another while. You smile at Tav. Let him see how good you feel. So, how you doing, bro? Got a little juice left in those gams?
I think I have enough juice for a little more walking around, he says, smiling right back with those sweet fangs. Did you have something in mind?
Let's head on up to the roof, you say. Pretty nice tonight. Think we could even see a few stars.
That sounds good to me, Tav says, and you take his hand to help him up to his feet.
Yeah, you'll go on up and watch some fucking stars together. Let the cool breeze whistle through your horns, and tell Tav another thing or two about Karkat, if the words will go together any kind of sensible. You got it together. You got your Tav, bro. You got a place of your own, and you got a plan. The end.
Oh my goodness. So low. Oh.
Finally Bred. Part 4 of the Pet Stuck series.
Written by Cephalopod. Read by Opalsong. The war ends, and Mrs. Crocker is happy about it. Things had been touch and go there for a while, she says. Touch and go, but our boys pulled through, didn't they? Yes, they did, just like we knew they would, and those terrible Germans won't be trying any of that nonsense ever again. Now we can all just go back to a normal life, she says. Can't we, Condi dear? And you say, of course, Ms. Crocker. Normal life means business is good at her little shop. She calls it her little shop, even if it is really the entire country. And soon there are parties again, loud, sparkling parties, and a new car to ride in. There is an otter fur coat for Mrs. Crocker, and another one for you, just a bit smaller. You look so pretty in it, she says. Aren't the two of you such a pair? Such a darling little thing. All her friends think so, too. They're positively green about you, she says. This means something different to Mrs. Crocker. You go with her to meetings and take notes for her. Everyone thinks this is delightful, and when you read something from them aloud for her, they gasp and tell her how lucky she is. You go with her to dinner. She winks at you sometimes, and holds out her glass of champagne for you to taste. It's not good for you, I know, she says, but it's such fun, isn't it? Business is good everywhere. You know what that means. Mrs. Crocker has you examined, and she is delighted. You are at a very receptive point in your cycle, she says, and she winks again. We'll have to make you even prettier than usual, won't we? Oh, Condi, how exciting! She buys you a pearl necklace and a girdle, because, she says. Not long after that, you drive with her into town. Your hair is perfect. You're wearing a nice dress and your girdle under it, because. She fusses over your stockings and pats your bust into the shape she likes best. The car is pulling to a stop, and she pulls something from her purse with a smile. Red lipstick. Now make your kissy face, she says. You do. Mrs. Crocker gets out of the car first. You haven't been to this part of town before, but it looks the same as the rest. She laughs and talks with someone outside while you sit there, and you hear them say how receptive your new friend is. And wouldn't it be wonderful if both of them took? Oh, how exciting! Mrs. Crocker calls you, and you come out. Condi, dear, come meet your new friend. Your new friend is standing next to Mrs. Crocker's friend. He is tall, even for a high-caste sea troll, and dressed like a fashionable gentleman, in a suit with a narrow waist between padded shoulders and loose pants. There is a shock of purple in his hair, between his short horns. His face is smooth. There is nothing especially remarkable about him, other than that hair. But you suppose it could always be worse. At least he's handsome. Madam, he says. Sir, you say. You lift your hand for him to take and kiss, which he does. You both look at your hand, not at each other's eyes yet. This is a politeness. Aren't they so old-fashioned? Mrs. Crocker's friend says. I think it's charming. They're like parrots, you know. They live for ages. Mrs. Crocker and her friend walk ahead of you to a cafe. They sit at a table, a small one, big enough for two. You move to stand behind her, but she waves you away. Go sit with your new friend, dear, she says. Order anything on the menu. This is a special day. Oh, she can read a menu? Her friend says. How clever! Isn't she? Mrs. Crocker says. Shoo now, go get to know each other. The waiter takes a long time to come, while you and your new friend sit across from each other.
This gives you a time to make pleasant conversation. Your new friend agrees that the weather is fine today and pays you a compliment on your hat. You tell him that it's a silly little thing, but thank you. At the next table, Mrs. Crocker beams to see you getting along so well. When the waiter comes, you order the lobster cocktail and champagne. Your friend orders exactly the same thing. Where he grew up, there were lobsters everywhere. He could tell you all sorts of things about lobsters. They're very unlucky animals, he says, to be so tasty and so unintelligent. He read somewhere that lobsters were the least intelligent crustacean. Intelligent things taste so much better, he says. More of a challenge, don't you think? He smiles. Mine doesn't read, Mrs. Crocker's friend whispers. My husband works for the State Department. It's safer that way. Your friend's ear fins flare, then flush violet. He becomes suddenly preoccupied with the button on his cuff. The champagne arrives. The champagne is delicious. You feel a little better when you drink it. It's easier to remember some of the things Mrs. Crocker talks about at parties. Human romance things, and human money things, and human war things. Your friend seems to like it when you talk about human war things. So you talk about the things you saw in newspapers. Your friend is drinking his champagne, too. He tells you that war is important, sometimes. And you nod. You've always known that war was important. But all those people killed, you say, isn't that a shame? Terrible, he says, terrible. His eyes don't mean it. You think you might like him. Cheers, you say. Cheers, he says. You clink. Mrs. Crocker and her friend over at the other table are delighted. They watch you both drink your champagne and eat your lobsters, and they drink iced tea with lemon and don't eat anything. As you finish, they lean over the table towards each other and whisper, "So compatible! Their cycles? Oh, yes, 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 yes! How exciting! Hadn't really considered, but why not?" And so on. All of you leave, and you get back in the car, but Mrs. Crocker gives you a butterscotch out of her purse and tells the driver to go to a different address, not home. It's some distance out from town, out where the houses and the lawns are both bigger, and there are pretty flowering trees. You're not sure if you've ever been to this neighborhood. It looks like the place you had your photograph taken for the calendar a few years ago, the charity one for the soldiers. Mrs. Crocker's friend's house is a very nice house with a long driveway with trees on either side. There is a rose garden in front, and you faintly smell troll mint growing somewhere. Your friend is lucky. He's here, too. When you go inside with Mrs. Crocker, her friend is sitting in the parlor fussing with your friend's purple stripe and straightening the shoulders of his jacket and brushing off his lapels and so on. You recognize pre-show preparations. Mrs. Crocker has already touched up your kissy face in the car. "Go hold her hand, darling," says Mrs. Crocker's friend. "Oh, the two of you are so precious together. I wish we had a photographer. You're going to make such pretty little ones." "Do you think?" Mrs. Crocker says. "Tyrian blood?" Your friend's claws dig into the back of your hand. "Oh, I hope so," says Mrs. Crocker's friend. "You'll try your hardest, won't you, darling?" "Yes, ma'am," he says. "Your hand hurts." Mrs. Crocker's friend shows both of you to a bedroom. Her son is away at university, she says. There are miniature models of warplanes hanging from the ceiling in attack formation. The bed is covered with a navy blue wool blanket, and there is a faint rancid scent of a young male human. They shut the door behind you, then open it up just a little. "Let nature take its course, dear," Mrs. Crocker says through the crack. Don't embarrass me, darling, her friend says. We'll just be in the kitchen. This is a familiar enough routine. Your cluster isn't engorged yet, but as a higher caste, it is your prerogative to claim the first mount, and you're unlikely to impregnate him without a little preparation. So you pull up your skirt, you push the crotch of your panties aside, and twine your fingers into your cluster. He removes his trousers completely to do the same. The resulting ensemble is not flattering. Just a moment, you say. Get onto the bed, please.
Don't tell me what to do, he says. This is my house. I'm in charge here.
Your fingers still. You didn't expect that. I beg your pardon? You ask, because you have the best manners.
I said, this is my house, he repeats.
The hell it is, you tell him.
You get on the bed, he says. Do it now. I'm going first.
You fist your hand and give your clusters a twist. This isn't your house, you tell him. Those aren't even your clothes. You're not going anywhere unless I tell you. Get on the floor if you like it that better. The polyps of his cluster are flushed violet, and a few are waving upright. One hand is still clamped over the mass of them, hard. The other jabs a finger towards your face.
I don't care how good you think you are, he says. You're here for me. I don't fucking care what you say. I don't fucking care.
Then get on the bed, you tell him. Get on the bed and ask nicely, and maybe I'll stuff some Tyrian grubs up your nook. Maybe you'll be worth something then.
He lunges for you, snarling.
He's taller than you, and you are faster than him. Very fast indeed. Both of you are strong and sharp. You tear around the room and tear it to pieces. He gets close enough to claw into the tail of your hair, and you miss his eyes by millimeters when you rake his face. You hate him. Your cluster is begging you to mutilate him, and somehow also to disdain him completely. Your nook demands you envelop him, crush him, destroy and consume him. It's terrifying. You hate him so much, so fast, you have absolutely no idea what to do about it. And you flee. Mrs. Crocker is furious. You don't know how you got here. The way outside races you through several rooms and finally a door, into the bright sun and the unfamiliar place. The car is there. You know the car. You hide under it and breathe terrible air and can't seem to catch your breath. You curl up as tight as you can. Your cluster aches. Mrs. Crocker's feet run up, and she insists that you come out. You won't. You are not ever coming out. Condi, she says, you will not make a scene. She drops a trollment sachet onto the ground next to you. Her shoe stamps upon it to grind it into the pavement, releasing the scent of it into the air. You hiss, but there is no hiding place better than the one you have. And you don't dare run. You can't get further away than the other side of the undercarriage. The musk of the mint follows you there and rides on the hot asphalt air into you. You huddle up against the tire while your mind starts to sparkle and slow. You want to kill Mrs. Crocker, her friend, your friend, everyone, everywhere. You want to cry. You're going to be culled. Eventually, she and the driver pull you out. You are not culled. You spend a week sleeping in the garage, and no treats for a month. Mrs. Crocker tells you that your friend will never be suitable for show again, and that you have no idea how much you cost her. Everyone is talking about it. Did you know you broke an entire set of Gallet Camaro glass tearing through the parlor like that? Did you? You did not know that. You are a bad troll, she says. A very, very bad troll. You tell her you're sorry. She'll put a collar on you, she says, if she can't trust you to act civilized in public. Is that what you want, Condi? No, Mrs. Crocker, you say. Well, then, she says, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad we straightened this out. She scratches your head between your horns and smiles. You get lobster for dinner.
The end. Solix. Proceed to day 23. Part 5 of the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opalsong. You have been in the Striders' apartment for 23 days. They still haven't started talking about getting rid of you. Wait, rehoming you. You're doing your best to keep your guard up, because the longer they wait to do it, the more likely it is to suck, but you can feel yourself slipping. On day 5, you stopped feeling the need to hide in small, dark places. Under Strider A's bed, in the entryway closet above the sword trap, once wedged into the space on top of the fridge. On day 9, you started coming out to the living room when they were home and watching what they were doing with the television. On day 10, Strider B offered to let you make your own profile on the Xbox and didn't act surprised that you could put in your own name with no hesitation. On day 13, Strider A asked if you enjoyed reading, and you hesitated a split second too long before you answered that trolls weren't supposed to be taught to read. On day 15, he brought you a battered little e-reader already loaded with a dozen books in various genres. You know it was probably just a placating gesture to keep you from being bored, but at least he was willing to put the effort in. You read all of the Complacency of the Learned series, and it's totally unrealistic, but still pretty cool. On day 20, you sat on the couch with them for dinner and later dessert, an apple pie they had to stick in the oven to warm up, easily the size of your head. You ate 3 pieces, and even when you were buzzing with energy from all that sugar, they didn't yell at you. It's day 23, and you can't keep doing this. You're going to let your guard down. You remember Strider A insisting that they were on your side that first night. You'd like to believe that. It makes you feel good in a wiggly, primitive part of your brain. From the reading you've done, and how fucked is that, learning about what's natural for your own species by reading it? You know that trolls who are left to their own devices, oh wait, wild trolls, tend to form small, tightly knit social groups, cohorts. Your instinct brain wants to have a few others around that you can depend on. Your stupid instinct brain is going to get the rest of you screwed over pretty bad, you're almost sure. It doesn't listen when you tell it to shut up, though. The Striders are up on the roof of the building, strifing each other. This is apparently a thing they do often. You aren't allowed to go up there and watch. Too soon, they said, when you asked why not. You picture it as looking a lot like one of their fighting games, but with less jiggle physics. They take their shitty blunt swords and a few bottles of Gatorade and are gone for an hour or so, sometimes even more, and come back down teasing each other and snarking and ready to order food for delivery. From the bruising afterward, it looks like Strider B always loses. Somehow, this still seems to be satisfying for both of them. You hear footsteps in the hall and pause the game you're playing, just in time to catch Strider A saying, "Guess I'll be the one to talk to him about it then." Your heart sinks as the key rattles in the lock. You hit the pause button with more force than necessary and go back to your game, trying to hold down the trembling tension as your stupid instinct brain does what it does best and gets sloppy emotion goo on everything. They say hi when they come in, and you nod, not looking up.
trying to act like you don't care. You don't. You'll be fine. Fuck. You hope that wherever they send you isn't too much worse. You run through options in your head as your character strafes an enemy position. You could try running away, but you really don't think you'd make it long as a feral. You're too small and not aggressive enough, and you might know a lot of things, but that doesn't mean you could do all the stuff you'd need to if you wanted to get by. You could try begging for mercy, awful as that sounds. You'd do it if you were sure it would work. Same with letting them do sex things to you. It would be something you could bargain with if you thought they'd take it. But from what you've seen of them, you don't think they would. They disappear into their rooms. You hear the shower running a minute later. You switch to your sniper rifle and take a careful headshot. The Xbox pings to let you know you've gotten an achievement for that. Video game problems are so easy. You advance to the next checkpoint. One of them bangs on the bathroom door and yells at the other one to hurry up and not use all the hot water. You switch to your plasma cannon. You are annihilating the enemy commander when Strider A sits down on the couch next to you. His hair is wet and he smells like soap. You thumb the green button in the middle of the controller and put it down. Okay, you say, turning to face him, your hands balled up in your lap. Hit me. He gives you a crooked smile. Should have figured you noticed something was up, he says. All right, let me level with you. You know me and Dave have been doing this fostering thing for a while, right? That seems painfully obvious, but you nod numbly all the same. So we've seen a lot of trolls come and go through here, some of them in pretty bad shape. It's like one of those things where the more you do it, the more you know it needs doing. I don't think we could give it up at this point. You nod shortly, and then you're squeezing your eyes shut and telling your instinct brain to just fuck off until you're done here, please. Ugh. Get it over with, you say. You're getting rid of me, though you have room for someone else. Hey, no, Strider A says, and then no again when you don't move. Not where this is going, dude. He puts a hand on your shoulder, and you open your eyes warily. Totally not where I was going with this, he says. So, you don't want to ask. You don't want to hope. But these have been such a good 23 days. So me and my bro talked it over, Strider A says. And we were thinking, maybe, if we're all on the same page about it, you might want to stick around for good. I know you came from an only troll house. And having rescues around can be stressful. So I want you to know that up front. And have a chance to say so if you'd rather go someplace quieter. You open your mouth to say yes, Yeth. Keep me. And he holds up a hand to stop you. Think about it a little bit before you answer, okay? How long? You ask. Gotta have a laid out clear, huh? He says. Give it at least until tomorrow. Take longer if you're still not sure. Okay. You say. You don't think you're going to say anything different tomorrow than you would right this minute. But he gets to make the rules. I guess maybe this would be a good time to start thinking of you by your actual names. He does the eyebrow thing. You're pretty certain by now that's a good sign. Actual names? He asks. Instead of Strider A and Strider B. You say, Strider B, fine, Dave, wanders into the living room in time to hear that part, and he says, what, not douchebag A and douchebag B? Not specific enough, you say. They let you say this kind of shit. They don't get mad. That could refer to anybody. Dirk holds out his fist, and you bump your knuckles against his. Stupid instinct brain makes your subvocal cords start to hum, and your cheeks get a little hot, because it's embarrassing to do that in front of someone. But they don't give you crap for it. You think they might sort of get what it means, as much as humans can. They order food, and you scoop out about half the carton of your favorite, the chicken in sticky sweet brown goo, and you're pretty sure it has never tasted better. They have a stupid competition to see who can stuff more of an egg roll in his mouth at one time, and Dave says something really rude about it when Dirk wins. And you don't catch what Dirk says back, but it makes Dave make a gagging noise and complain about too much information. You start to wonder if you can exhaust your subvocal cords, and if so, how long it takes. After dinner, the three of you have an impromptu fighting game tournament. The Striders switch between spinning records and being your opponent. They're dirty cheaters, but they don't mind if you are too, so it almost works out. It would be better if you were fast enough to screw up their combos more often, but it's still good. It's late by the time they shut everything down. Not just turn the volume down so the neighbors will stop banging on the walls, but actually turn off the speakers and put the computers to sleep. It's almost trollish, the schedule they run on. You change from your jeans into pajama pants in the bathroom. It doesn't even bother you anymore that the door doesn't lock. And then go padding back into Dirk's room. You have a pile there, in the corner. Some spare cords and cables layered with those fuck-ugly plushes that Dirk likes so much. Dirk is already in bed. The lights are off, but you see him just fine without them. Your pile is right there. It's comfortable and familiar. It's not what your instincts tell you to want. You stand there and argue with yourself for a little bit longer, because you sort of have to. This is stupid. Just because he told you that you could stay, you shouldn't want to... You hate having instincts sometimes. They get in the way so much. Clearly, you've been standing there long enough to make your stupidity obvious. Dirk rolls over. "Sol, you okay?" he says. "Yeth," you say. "Fine." You drop your jeans on your pile and step away from it. When you get to the edge of his bed, you can see his expression. Wary, confused, eyebrows drawn down in a frown, eyes just slightly narrowed. He isn't bothering to mask his expression the way he does with the light on, and you wonder for a second if he knows how well you can see. "Sol?" he says. He doesn't stop you from pulling back his blanket, and he's holding very, very still when you climb into his bed. He's so much bigger than you, and you realize as you lie down that you don't have any idea where to put your limbs. "Why does anyone want to do this? Why do you?" "Talk to me," Dirk says, quietly, really serious. "What are you looking for here?" He feels tense against you. It's weird. "You said you would be my cohort," you say. "Fuck, you sound defensive." "Did you just mean it metaphorically?"
Dirk
smiles crookedly. "Listen to you," he says. "Metaphorically," he says. "I know guys who go through high school without being able to use words that big." You preen a little. You're entirely self-taught, and it's like he's petting your pride directly when he notices you're good at it. That sort of makes it okay to not quite know what you're doing here. Maybe you can let him know. "I never really got this cloth with douchebags A through D," you tell him. He snorts. "So, I don't know where to put my arm." This time, his noise is less of a snort and more like an actual laugh. "I'm afraid nobody does," he says. "There isn't really a right answer." "Oh," you say. You feel silly and reassured at the same time. Then, here. He shifts, opening his arms and sliding one around you, under your neck and warm against your back. You pillow your head on his shoulder. Your bottom arm has to smush up against your chest, and that's awkward. But the top one just drapes over his chest, and that's not bad at all. He's so warm.
So this is what you want, huh?
He says. You can feel the vibrations of his voice in his chest.
A little cuddling?
If that's okay, you say, as you realize that maybe you're asking for something unreasonable. Most of what you know about human socializing comes from watching television at the douchebag's house, and the Striders don't act like that much. And just because they talk like they understand what you need doesn't mean it's what they need. And
did I just start something, Elf?
Now you're the one who's tense.
But Dirk says, whew,
a big sigh of air leaving his lungs, and you can feel how he relaxes all the way against you.
No, it's totally cool. I just wanted to make sure you weren't looking for something else. Because I like you a lot, but not in a pants-off way.
Oh, good. The thing you had just knotted up under your ribs unknots again. Because I would have, but I don't really want to. Dirk shakes his head.
We don't pull that bullshit in this house, he says. Everybody involved has to want to, or the game is called on account of consent fail.
Your hum starts back up, and you don't bother feeling embarrassed about it this time.
That's a good rule, you say. Ought to be everybody's fucking rule, Dirk says.
He sounds a little bit angry, but it's not scary for some reason. And then you realize why. What he's doing is a human's way of growling protectively. You rub your cheek against his shoulder, and your hum gets louder. Dirk shifts, rolling toward you so he's lying on his side too, and drapes his arm over you, pulling you close in against his chest.
You're safe here, okay? We got your back, me and Dave.
You nod fiercely, winding your fingers into his shirt and holding on. I'm going to say yes tomorrow, you tell him. I'd have to be stupid to give this up. Dirk kisses your forehead, right at your hairline.
You're miles away from being stupid, he says, so I guess we'll make it official in the morning.
Yes, you say. You feel good, relieved and balanced and comfortable. In this little place in the back of your mind that has been twitchy and defensive for so long that you forgot how to feel anything else. So it's weird having that change. You find yourself sort of shaking. Dirk just holds you, stroking your back slowly, his breathing steady and slow. You hope he's comfortable, because suddenly you really want him to just let you stay right there, to let you fall asleep still wrapped up in this safe feeling. He does. The end. Jake, come up with a capital idea. Part 6 of the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opalsong.
Good golly, this is exciting. Your truck bounces and rattles up the narrow dirt road towards the turnoff, the morning sun glinting off your rear view. You've been looking forward to this opportunity all month, ever since you contacted the university about the site you found. And even more so, once they got back to you to let you know that it was significant enough to investigate further. A lost piece of frontier history! And now you get to go visit and see what the experts are uncovering. You do hope you'll have time to poke around a good deal before the sun drops behind the mountains. You pull in at the little washout on the side of the road that's become the staging area for the excavation.
There are two university vans parked there, and also a truck from the local troll welfare department. What are they doing here? Well, the best way to find out is to go looking. You grab your hat off the passenger seat, pocket your keys, and set off up the rocky incline into the woods. You've come up this way a few times before. You go hiking and climbing pretty much anywhere that isn't posted no trespassing. And occasionally places that are, even though Jane tries to discourage you. It's so hard to turn away from a challenging cliff face. You know the trails the mule deer use, and you keep a sharp, hopeful, eye out for cougars. And you watch your footing, even though you have good boots on, because you can't be too careful of rattlers when the weather is warm. You follow the path the excavation team marked on their way in. Little pink tape flags on the black bark of pine trees, lurid enough to be visible in all sorts of weather. Already, the trail is considerably more obvious than it was the first time you made your way out here. And they haven't even been on the site for long. It's amazing how much of an effect humans can have on their environment sometimes. When you reach the site, the university types are talking to the troll welfare chap, a serious fellow in a khaki uniform, holding a rifle. Heavens, you say. Is there a fugitive on the loose? The fellow gives you a grim nod, and the woman in charge of the excavation, Dr. Markey, if you're remembering correctly, tells you, the site has been disturbed, and there are marks indicating we probably have a feral troll on the loose. Or, God forbid, a pack of them. The troll welfare fellow shakes his head. Doubt it's more than one, he says. The leavings we've seen are consistent with a lone female defining her territory. Just have to see if we can flush her out. Might need to bring dogs for that. But sometimes they come quietly if they haven't been out here long. They realize it's not all fun and games being out here where nobody feeds you and there are bigger predators to worry about. You try to curb your excitement. You've seen trolls before, of course, but there's something about the word feral that makes this sound like a frightful adventure. She should be slow right now, sleeping, if we're lucky, the troll welfare fellow goes on. When they go feral, they tend to go back to a mostly nocturnal pattern pretty fast. Look for her where there's shelter, cover from the sun, and if you think you see her, don't get close. She may want to defend her territory, and even if she doesn't, she could still do plenty of harm just trying to run. Let me be the one to actually handle her. You nod, already scanning the site, wondering what this wild troll is like. Where did she come from? Is she entirely wild, or does she know how to speak like a human? What led her to come up here? The site is ruins of an old frontier fort, as best you could tell, detritus of a lost group of settlers who met an obscure and tragic end. You'd think there must be better shelter to be found elsewhere nearby. Caves in the mountains that would keep her safe more thoroughly than the rotting remains of a long fallen palisade. The five of you, you, the troll welfare chap, and the three members of the university team, spread out across the site. It's probably not so large, as these things go, but you're still impressed with it. Between the sparse trees, you can make out the remains of the fortress wall, and there are hollows in the ground that would have been cellars when the buildings were still standing. A lot of the site is overgrown with scrub brush and young trees. You ask yourself, if I were a small nocturnal predator looking to den here, where would I hide? You make your way through the brush, looking for hollows that would provide protection from the sun or from casual passers-by. No luck in the first one, or the second. But the third time, you peer into the shadows under a slump of collapsed rocks, and the grays and browns resolve into a living shape. Bare limbs, body covered in furs, a sort of makeshift hood where her brightly colored horns would give her away. You take a sharp breath, your heart pounding. The troll's eyes snap open and fix straight on you. Egg yolk yellow and rust red. She has her limbs coiled under her in an instant, already diving past you by the time you can yell for help. The hood flies back as she darts away. Her hair is a tangle of long black braids, and her horns curl like a ram's. She's quick and agile, but when the welfare fellow's tranquilizer gun cracks, she still stumbles. You can see her trying to reach the dart in her shoulder while she's still running, but she fumbles, her steps slowing, and before she's made it past the fort wall, she's collapsed in a little heap. Your heart is in your throat. You think you might have wanted her to escape in the heat of the moment. The welfare fellow is barking some nonsense at you about being careful as you walk towards the troll. She's out cold, no threat to anyone at the moment, and you want a better look. She's a lovely little thing. She'd probably come up about to your shoulder, standing, and her bone structure has this kind of spareness to it that puts you in mind of a cheetah or a greyhound. She has broad cheekbones with hollows under them that you suspect are a sign of hunger. And your heart aches for her, wild and alone out here. The welfare fellow gets close enough to examine her, rolling her onto her back and prying an eyelid open. And you discover that she's belted her furs on with a scrap of red mountain climbing rope and decorated the belt by hanging skulls from it. You can scarcely believe she's real.
Nice clean capture, just the way we like them, the welfare fellow says. He shoulders his rifle and picks up the troll. She looks tiny in his arms. I'll just be getting this little troublemaker back to town, then. Good luck with your digs. We'll probably hear all about it in the paper, won't we?
I certainly hope so, Dr. Markey says. And thank you for coming out on such short notice. It'll make our jobs a lot easier, not having to worry about stumbling over an angry troll.
The welfare chap takes his charge off down the trail, and you must admit you're a bit sorry to see him go so soon. You can practically hear Jane scolding you for your irresponsibility, but it would have been exciting to have it be trickier to find the troll. Still, there are all sorts of archaeological excitements to be had at the site, and soon enough you're engrossed in them, as Dr. Markey sketches out for you how the fort would have run and what the remaining artifacts have to say about the men who built it. And then, a few minutes later, the fellow trudges back into the clearing with the troll nowhere to be seen.
Oh dear, Dr. Markey says, sounding far more distressed than you feel. Don't tell me she's escaped.
No, ma'am, the welfare fellow says. She's snug in the back of the truck, out like a light. Fan belt's busted, though, and I can't get any damn reception up here to call for help.
Then allow me to offer my assistance, you say. I can give you a lift back to town. The fellow frowns a bit.
Even with the troll? He asks. Don't want to leave her in the back of the truck long enough for me to head down to town and back again. Not with the way it's heating up already.
No, certainly not. You agree. That would be inhumane. We could buckle her up in the cab of my truck, couldn't we? There's room.
Could do, the fellow agrees, nodding slowly. And I'd much appreciate it.
Think nothing of it, you say. Lead the way, sir.
So he does. You trek back to the road, and he removes the troll from the cage in the back of his truck, bundling her into the cab of yours. He puts cuffs on her, wrist and ankle, in case of trouble, and you buckle her in. She seems much younger when she's unconscious. She's the size of a human child, and when she's not alert, it's easy to see that resemblance instead of her own wildness. Once she's secured, the welfare fellow fetches his gear, and you pile into the truck yourselves. Windows cranked down to let the air in, because, golly, it is going to be a scorcher today. You're sure glad you were around to help out.
The troll stirs and starts to wake up before you're halfway down the mountain.
She makes a little mewling noise at first, twisting and squirming in her seat. You're a bit worried about that, bracing yourself in case she tries to shove you while you're driving. But when she wakes up all the way, she goes still instead of moving more. She sits up a little straighter. When you glance over, she's squinting against the sunlight. But she smiles brightly at you when she catches your eye. "Hi," she says. "If I ask where we're going, I'm going to be sorry, aren't I?" You are utterly flummoxed, tongue-tied, trying to decide what to say. You feel like you should apologize, good grief. And the troll welfare chap says, "Just into town. Do you have somebody who will be missing you?" She's chewing on her lip when you spare her another glance. There isn't a terribly good answer to that, is there? If I say yes, you'll ship me back to somebody that I clearly didn't stick with. If I say no, you'll dump me in a cage somewhere so I can wait around for some other human to decide to take me home.
Easiest if you tell the truth to start with, the fellow says. Not here to make this hard for you, but you can't just be running around wild in someone's woods.
Drat, the troll says with feeling. It's one of the most charming things you've ever heard. Her exasperated sigh is right up there, too. No, I don't have a human anymore, she says. He took me up in the mountains with him last fall. It was supposed to be a camping trip, but there was an accident. He fell.
Good gravy, that's terrible, you say. Must have been frightening.
It was at first, she says. Then I figured out how to hunt and find decent shelter and so on, and it got a lot easier.
You're grinning a bit at that. Like a troll version of Robinson Crusoe, you say. Or my side of the mountain, I suppose. Did your owner have you chipped? The welfare fellow asks. He doesn't seem nearly so thrilled by the idea of her adventures as you are.
She scrunches down in the seat. Yes, she says.
We'll look him up then. We always get a few mishaps in outdoor season. And, wait, the fellow stops for a moment. Last fall, You remember that guy they had to have a manhunt for? What was his name?
You raise an eyebrow, glancing over at him, over the troll's head, even though you're going round a curve.
I can't remember his name for the life of me, but I know the one you mean, you say. Brought in helicopters and police dogs and so forth. Too late when they found him, though.
The troll covers her mouth with her cuffed hands, so you can't rightly see what face she's making. Her eyes are very wide.
I'm sorry, you say to her. Even if she didn't like the chap, that was a fairly beastly way of breaking the news. That was frightfully insensitive of me. You glance at the welfare fellow. What happens to a troll who's lost her human, anyway?
Once we've confirmed it, she goes into shelter custody, the fellow says. We'll make sure her shots are up to date, probably give her a bath.
You think he's grimacing at that bit.
And see if we can find her a new home. She's young, and she's pretty under all that grime, so it shouldn't be too hard.
She's also sinking progressively further into the seat as the explanation goes on. She doesn't seem excited by the prospect of going back to civilization at all.
To be fair, you think, you never liked being dragged home from adventures for the sake of a bath, either.
Or, she says abruptly, seizing your sleeve, I could go with you.
What?
You say, because that's awfully sudden. And perhaps you stamp on the brake a bit harder than you meant to as you come down the next incline. We barely know each other.
That happens all the time, though, she says. I'll make it worth your while.
Here now, the welfare fellow says, which is just as well as it covers up for your furious blushing and coughing fit. None of that.
Your friends back there were looking for things in the ruins, weren't they? The troll goes on, heedless of her handler's complaints. You admire her moxie quite a bit.
You'll need my help for the best bits. I've found them already, You wish you weren't driving. You keep wanting to just drop everything and stare at her.
You've been digging up the old fort?
There were all sorts of interesting things there, she says. And I took the best ones. There's coins, harness bits, I think some pieces of an old rifle.
She hesitates a moment.
A couple of skulls, too.
The welfare fellow clears his throat. You can't hold those things hostage, he says.
You frown.
That's rather a harsh way of putting it, don't you think? You say. I think a bit of bargaining is a clever move for a girl in a tricky spot. You think of some of the movies you've seen. Of course, if you try to get me to fall for any sort of booby traps, all bets are off.
She giggles, and gosh darn it, you're actually thinking about whether you could give her a home.
I promise I'll disarm all the booby traps, just for you.
You're coming into town now, and the welfare fellow doesn't look like he approves at all. But it sounds like such a grand adventure. You have that ranch you inherited from your grandmother. There would be plenty of room there for a troll to run around, wouldn't there?
That sounds like an offer a gentleman couldn't refuse, you tell her. You can call me Jake, by the way.
She grins at you, and all of her teeth are sharp as the dickens, and you don't mind a bit.
I'm Aradia, she says. It's a lovely name. The end. Terezi, Be the Alpha. Part 7 of the Pet Stuck series. Written by Layla. Read by Opalsong. Author's notes. This one goes right after the break in Gamzee, Be the Considerate Idiot. You help yourself to another bowl of spaghetti after Gamzee goes out the window, because red is the most delicious flavor. Come sit with me, you tell Karkat, and you crawl under the kitchen table with your food, even though that is usually against the rules, because there is a time for the human's rules and there is a time for insisting on yours. Karkat follows you. You shove spaghetti into your mouth and chew, relishing the tang of red all over the squishy noodles. They don't scare you at all, he says. You swallow and shake your head. Not these ones, you say. One of the striders has turned on the TV. You can hear the jangly opening theme of Mad Snacks, Yo. I've dealt with terrible humans before, though. You take off your sunglasses. Holy shit, Karkat whispers. You can smell panic coming off him in waves. You put your sunglasses back on. I know how bad it can get, you say. I know how hard it is to get anything like fairness out of them when they want to be cruel. The growl rises in the bottom of your voice. But while you're here, you're part of my cohort. Mine and Solix's, and we'll look after you. Karkat is quiet for a minute. You breathe deeply, trying not to let yourself get distracted by your spaghetti, trying to smell him. He's so lost. You wonder who his humans were. You wonder if anyone did anything at all to punish them, or if they just confiscated Karkat and thought that was enough. Your blood pusher twinges. Here, you say, holding out your bowl. You have the rest. What? Karkat says. Suspicion thrums through his voice.
You raise your eyebrows. Not still hungry? You ask. He snatches the bowl out of your hands. You listen to the slurping and smacking sounds as he murders your bowl of spaghetti and destroys the evidence.
It's hard to believe, he says. No, don't worry, Karkat. It's fine. You've spent years with humans who treated you like shit and fucked you around constantly, but these ones are different.
Pretty much, you agree. You grin. I told Dave I would bite off anything he touched me with when he brought me home.
Karkat sputters.
thanks, he says. I keep feeling like you must be lying to make me feel better, but it's still sort of working, so thanks. You giggle. Comforting noises achieved, you declare. Also, dinner. This meeting is declared a resounding success. You reach out and find Karkat's arm. Onward! What? He squawks as you lead the way out from under the table. Wait, no, where are we going? Someplace more comfortable, you say.
Not until you put your bowl in the sink, Dirk says from the other room.
A tiny bit of you is annoyed at the nagging, but most of you doesn't mind. The rules here are consistent, and they have reasons, and everyone has to follow them. Put your dirty dishes in the sink is a good rule. Much better than stay off the furniture, Terezi.
As if I need reminding, you answer.
Karkat fetches the bowl, so you don't have to go hunting for it yourself. You dump it in the sink and run some water in it, so the last sauce bits won't get dried on. Then you hook your arm around Karkat and drag him into the living room with you. Gentlemen, you say, addressing the general direction of the couch, we are adjourning to the pile. No humans allowed.
That's cool, Rez. Nobody wants to be invited to your crazy monster parties anyway, Dave says.
You stick your tongue out at him.
What about me? Solix asks.
Solix, you have many flaws, you say gently, but being human isn't one of them.
Okay, he says.
You hear shifting from the couch, and then you can smell him coming closer. The gray velvet smell of troll skin and the electric, crackly overtone that means Solix in particular.
Hi.
Your eyes are weird, Karkat says.
I like your horns, Solix answers.
Oh, fuck you, Karkat says, and Solix snickers. You will have to investigate Karkat's horns.
This way, you tell Karkat. You drag him down the hall without running either of you into a doorway, even once.
Continued success!
He needs to see you at your best right now. And thus, you tell him as you reach the door to Dirk's room, we retire to our pile in triumph. You pull him into the room with you and flop down face first into the pile.
So, what, you like, they let you have a nest in here? Karkat asks.
Nope, Solix says. It would be a nest if we were birds, but apparently with trolls, everyone just calls it a pile.
Could be worse, you say, as you push Smuppets around to arrange the pile to your liking, and to make sure Pyro Sprite is still in his spot.
They could have decided to call them mounds. That's a stupid word.
I'm going to remember that next time I need to get on your nerves, Solix says.
You pull a Smuppet from the pile and throw it at him.
I forbid it, you say.
Sometimes that works.
How do you know what everyone says, anyway? Karkat asks.
The internet, Solix says. You can almost taste his smugness.
I'm allowed on Dirk's computer when he's not using it.
Silence for a second.
You're shitting me, Karkat says finally.
Or else I'm hallucinating this whole evening.
Neither, you say. Now get down here. Curling up together in a pile satisfies a basic emotional need for our species. Solix's internet says so.
Karkat is still muttering in cranky disbelief as he shuffles over and climbs down onto the pile. You feel Solix sink down on your other side, knees and elbows curling up to you. Karkat still smells wary. You think about how careful Dave was to tell you in advance before he did things when you first arrived here.
I'm giving you this to help you settle in, you say, digging Senator Lemonsnout out of the pile.
A stuffed dragon with a noose on, Karkat says.
You know that just makes me more sure I'm hallucinating.
You giggle.
I regret to inform you that you are completely misguided, you say. But your sass gland appears to be uninjured. That's a good sign.
Karkat makes an incredulous noise, and you add, also, I'm going to put an arm around you.
You can smell the sharpness coming off him, and feel how the pile shifts under you when he tenses.
Nothing else, he says. You can't tell if that's supposed to sound like a plea or a threat.
Nothing else, you agree.
You hope his humans are dead in a ditch. Maybe even the same ditch with your old humans. On fire would also be good. He's jittery and tense when you drape your arm over his middle, so you just lie still.
This is the life, you tell them both. Right in the middle where it's the warmest.
You think you're so smart, Solix says.
Only because it's demonstrably true, you say.
He snorts, but doesn't argue.
Karkat squirms after a minute, and you think maybe he's trying to shift closer, not away.
What's the catch? He asks quietly. I can't cope with this.
You chew your lip.
We're still not people, you tell him. Legally.
You don't want to bullshit him. You can smell his fear and his determination, and the combination punches you right under the ribs.
It's the nicest cage they can manage to provide for us, and they both treat us like they care what we want. But we don't have rights like humans do, and that won't change.
What about Gamzee? Karkat asks.
He'd never had a human, Solix says. He lives in an alley and eats garbage a lot of the time.
But he threatens to break out the window if they try to convince him to stick around, you finish.
Karkat huffs, but you think he's relaxing a little.
Okay, he says. So it does still suck. Either freedom or comfort, not both.
He laughs a little. I might actually believe this is happening now.
Suckitude for all, you agree. You run your hand up and down Karkat's back a little, gentle with your claws, so you don't snag his shirt or anything. He calms down a little more.
But we look out for each other.
He puts a tentative arm around you, leaving Senator Lemonsnout squished between you. You feel Solix's knuckles brush your back as he takes Karkat's hand.
Good.
It isn't perfect here. Perfect is way out of reach. But it's better than where you were before, and where Solix was before, and where Karkat was before, too. You wiggle down into the pile with your shoulders and hum as they both curl in closer to you. Together, your little cohort will be fine. The end.